Okay. Yeah, Doug Randall's here.
Morning.
You want to have a seat?
No.
Oh, I set up all these dandy mics for you.
All right, let's sit down then. Let's
all.
Okay, let's be official here. My God.
Now, where were you? Now, well, that's the first question. What are you so late for?
I was over on McLean and Company's television show. They were taping it.
Mm-hmm.
They broke the tape or something in the middle of it, and that's why we were late.
Well, that's a pretty flimsy
terrible
excuse, you know.
A lot of union trouble. There was a strike in the middle of the show.
If you're going to make it in this radio business, you really have to learn to be, you know, prompt. Right.
Oh, that's right. That's any business.
Is that right?
If you're going to hold up a bank and you arrive 20 minutes after it closes, it's no good.
Well, maybe if your plan is to break in after they closed.
No, the doors are locked, and you got problems. You got to pry them open with a screwdriver and all that.
Are you, you used to be a bankrupt?
No, I've studied it, though. I've thought about it.
Uh-huh. Well,
I never dismiss any possibility.
The people you said have said that you're stealing money by doing your radio show, too. Gene Shepherd is here with us, by the way. I didn't introduce you. You like to be known as Shep.
That's what I have been known as all my life.
We were talking earlier, and remember we were talking about it in your stories that you tell and your anecdotes and all. You don't refer to yourself as having a name. You don't say that you have a name.
No, I'm always using a metaphysical I.
But you have said Shep. You say Shep all the time, but you use it in factual relations.
Yeah, well, that's when I'm talking to guys at the White Castle, stuff like that.
Right. You're here to plug.
I have a credit card there.
Oh, do you?
One of the few guys that has a credit.
At the White... That's great.
Also White Tower.
Can I join you for a hamburger sometime?
Yeah, I buy and buy the sack.
Mm-hmm. We had some questions phoned in from our listeners here.
Oh, really? You have listeners?
Yes.
That's
well, you're not on. You're not on right now, so that they have something... They have to find something else to listen to, you know? let's see. Well, first of all, there's a hearty Excelsior from the western suburbs of Philadelphia.
I see. They're still here.
They're still here. Mm. The people that live there, I think, is...
I'll tell you. It takes guts to live there all those times.
Now, here's a question. I know you'll love this one. When did you stop saying that Saturday night is a poor man's Mardi Gras?
I don't recall saying that.
Next. a question about the music on your show. Where do you get the music? And where can they
get it? Where do I get it? Well, I invent all that. That music is actually non-existent. It's a concept, and I radiate a concept on the show. There's no such music, really.
I understand. Have you been back to Alaska?
No.
Okay, and this may be a long one. People...
They're referring on... I did a television show in Alaska. Right. That's what they're talking about.
Right, as part of Gene Shepherd's America.
Yeah, isn't that an egotistical title?
Yes. Well, that's kind of...
I'm Gene Shepherd's America. I got it right in my hand. Yeah, I don't like that.
That does suit you, I guess.
I liked it up in Alaska, though. The person probably thinks that when you go out and do shows, you immediately run back and go up to the place again. But we were there doing a television show, but I don't think I'll go back unless there's something unusual happens that I have to leave hurriedly.
Was it cold up there?
And the only places left is Nome. Was it cold? No, actually, no. We were up north of the Arctic Circle part of the show. We recorded some of it about 40 or 50 miles north of the circle, right on the Arctic Ocean. And it was kind of surprising, the temperature there. It was in August, and the temperature was, in the high 60s, something like that.
You didn't end the show with singing There's No Place Like Nome, did you?
Oh, no. I did sing, though, California, Here I Come.
Oh, well, you went out to California.
Yeah,
I saw your Hawaii show, which is remarkable, shots of surfing and so on. The question was, do you care to tell us about the Great Ice Cream War?
Oh, well, that's a story, and that would take a good half hour.
We've got all night. Oh,
no.
We don't.
No, that's you might call it my routines or a story I tell. I guess a lot of people don't recognize that my stories are like, the things I tell and things that people ask for. That's a good question, you know. That may explain something to you. You've listened to me before, haven't you? You probably wonder sometimes, you'll hear me do a story that I did before.
Mm-hmm.
And you may wonder why. Well, here's an example. The people, they want to hear a story again.
Right.
And sometimes I will do a live performance and I won't tell a story that any of them have heard. And they'll all like the ones I tell. But then they'll come up and say, gee, why didn't you tell so-and-so? Why didn't you tell? In other words, they want you to keep doing the same story. And that's one of the things that performers really have to fight against, because if you let somebody convince you to tell that story again and again, ultimately the very guy that's asked that will say, gee, the trouble with you is you never tell new stuff.
Right.
That happened to Bob Newhart.
Right, that's the old comedian's curse, I guess.
Yeah.
But in a way, it's like singing performers and so on being asked to do their greatest hits.
That's right.
And then they get tired of doing their greatest hits after a while.
Well, also, so does the audience in a curious way. They begin to blame him or her for the very thing they want them to do.
Right.
I've heard people say, oh, all she does is sing Judy Garland, all she sings is Over the Rainbow.
And if she doesn't?
If they demand their money back.
Right. Well, then the answer is it's a mixture of old and new? Is that what you do?
No, I really don't do that in performance. If I'm playing Princeton or playing something like Ryder College, one of the big schools out in the East, I put together a show before I go in there that I want to do, and I don't think in terms of whether it's old or new. It's just a show that I feel like doing, and like I just played Princeton, and I did entirely new material, which I'd never done before. The whole show, 2.5 hours.
I saw you once in a concert at Irvine Auditorium at Penn, which must have been in, I guess 67 or 68, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't use any notes.
No,
right?
No.
Do you use notes?
For heaven's sakes, can you imagine Mort Saul out on the stage using notes?
Oh, well, then do you use notes when you're on the radio? You were mentioning that you have...
Not real notes, no. Of course, you see, when I'm doing a performance on the stage, that's really a little bit different in a way, because that's a different medium, again. It's the stage, and I'm conditioned by what kind of a stage it is, the physical situation there. If I walk out like I'm doing Irvine, that's a huge hall, a great big stage, and so I can do a lot of things which allow me to move all over the stage. Now, if I'm doing a show, let's say in an auditorium where they have a little narrow stage, and by some reason or other they have a fixed lectern, and you got to work behind this little thing, then I'll do something else.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, on my radio show, I prepare a show in my mind for maybe 2 or 3 weeks prior to the time I do it. But it's all mental now at this point. I don't need regular notes. I know what I'm doing. When I go in, I marshal, in other words, I think of a kind of an outline in my head. I know where I'm going.
How do you get to, you have to finish it, though, in 45 minutes, though. You ever
get that's part of the...
You have to get to the end, and you got to get to the end and be around the end of the show, right?
Well, all my shows have a certain basic... In fact, that's the most important part of storytelling, is timing.
Yeah.
So when I go in to do a show, you'll notice if you listen to one of my shows, it has a beginning like an introduction, and then it has a slow beginning like almost like a symphony. And then I build up to the station break, which is at 12, like 10:30.
Right now, in fact, WMMR Philadelphia.
Good, that was a nice break. And I build up, and then I build up the second section, again at a lower level, all the way on up. That's the second half hour, until finally when I go off the air, just about the time I'm about to go off, like, say, a minute before the theme, I hit what could be called the peak of the story. The theme is coming on behind me. Now, to my audience, they always think I just barely made it.
Right, right.
Whereas, as a matter of fact, that's part of the technique.
Wow, that's great. You know, you do them live most of the time.
Oh, yes. Right?
But occasionally you do put them on tape.
Yeah, I'm on tape maybe 2 or 3 nights out of the week.
You'll be live tonight?
I have an option. I have a taped show. It depends on whether I get back to New York in time. I also have a show already in my head that I can do.
Uh-huh. How many do you have backlog? Do you have a couple in the can?
I usually, in case, you know, you never know, something may come up, you know, like I may drive my Fiat through a brick wall or something. So I usually have, you never know. So I usually have about 4 or 5 shows that are in the can in case of any emergency, if I really have to be gone. But I'm, in general, now I'm going to go out on a tour. I'm going to go on a university tour. Beginning the 15th of December, I'm going to go down to such diverse places as the University of Missouri and various places, and I won't be back till around Christmas, thereabouts. Now, I will be, of course, on tape then. And I will be taping. I have been taping shows for that sequence.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we usually ask people that come up here what they think about music. And we usually talk to people that are involved in music. You're involved in so many kinds of things, radio and television, and you write books and magazine articles and things. Do you have any thoughts on music?
Sure. You know, if you've heard my LP, I have some of my Jew's harp work on.
I was going to ask you about that.
Well, you hear it on the LP? Have you heard that whole LP?
You know, I haven't heard that. It was a surprising story.
I'm Jew's harp, and I also do some head thumping on that disc.
We should hold it up to the microphone right now, like we do occasionally. Tell them that it's the declassified Gene Shepherd. The public has a right to know. And it's on Mercury, and it's just coming out, I think, this week. It's being released and has a dandy drawing of you on the front in your little army hat. You look really, really fine.
I'm very dignified.
We have Doug Randall here, who is one of the top twanger players in the East. And we thought maybe we'd...
Jewish harpist?
Yes.
Well, that's mine. Could we
possibly influence you to... To do a duet? Right. Well, let's get that. Want to do a duet?
Well, maybe later.
Oh, okay.
You
were going to tell us about music.
Well, I nothing I could tell you about music except that I've been around all my life professionally. And you may know that I recorded at one time with Charlie Mingus.
That was the Clowns album.
A pretty good bass player. And I used to... music is such an integral part of my life. It's hard for me to say, what can I say about it? It's like saying, what do you think of breathing? You know?
Well, what I meant was, I know you're a little cynical about the rock stardom trip and the state of that kind of thing, and the idols. Well, anything you want to say?
Not really. I think that today. I don't think the public gives many performers a chance. I'm talking about particularly rock performers. Give them a chance to develop. In other words, it's very common for a rock group or a rock musician to be a big international success 8 weeks after they were formed. And they can't go anyplace after that. They're locked in, just like that comic who's locked into the same story all the time. And they have to perform that sound.
Right, their greatest hits forever and ever. And they have their 15th album of their greatest hits,
volume 6. Well, then, of course, they quickly die. That's why so many rock groups have a very short life, because the only way that a performer can have a long life and really begin to contribute something really important to a society is if he's allowed to experiment with his work to the point where he can move it in almost any direction. But, artistically, he can do things. He learns his instrument. He learns himself. Whereas a kid that suddenly becomes a $80,000 a concert star at the age of 22, even the agency that books him won't let him change. He's afraid himself. He's afraid that because the minute he starts to change, immediately he's attacked by all his fans. This happened to Dylan. Changed. And
a couple of times he's changed.
Yeah, and every time he's attacked. Because they want him to stay the way the Bobby we love and admire.
You've basically been doing the same kind of thing, I guess, in your radio show for how many years now? Is it 10 years?
You mean as a comic? You're asking me if I've been basically a humorist? Yes, I've been a humorist. Radio is just one medium I use. See, I don't feel myself part of radio, because radio is another field. Radio is basically records, interviews, and news. And I guess I'm an oddball in that I use radio as a performing medium rather than as an interviewing medium or as a medium of showing other people's work. And so I don't really consider myself in radio. I'm just as much in writing. I'm a consistent writer for Playboy. I've just finished a TV series and I do a lot of concert work. This is something I do more than anything else in the performing world. I play 30 to 40 concerts a year.
I've heard a couple of commercials, I think. You do, was it the High Karate commercials? Is that you?
Are they out? Yeah, I did them.
I saw one, yeah. Yeah. Just your voice. It's just your voice, right?
Well, I do a lot of on-camera stuff. I did a whole series mostly for out of town. You know, there's a lot of commercials that are done for other cities in New York. And they don't want people really to identify the guy. They want it to be a guy they don't know. Yeah, they do. So I do a lot of commercials that are in Chicago, for example. I did a whole series for the Chicago Sun-Times, which are on camera. I've done a lot of commercials, but many of them are voiceover. I do a lot of narration, too, in New York. I did.
You do a lot of things. How do you find the time?
Well, you've got to keep working. See, I think you will, too, eventually.
Yeah.
See, I think that once you realize that as a performer, you have a great, there's a great latitude. In other words, if you work with yourself, in other words, you develop your technique, your acting technique, you develop your performing technique and narration technique. In other words, when you become a professional, you'll be able to do narrations, you'll be able to do movie work. I think of myself as a performer, not necessarily a radio man.
Do you see anybody else coming along that does the kind of thing that you do? I can't think of anybody that even could approach the ease of which you tell your stories and convince people that these are your personal recollections when, you know, indeed they're just...
No, they
just,
are partly personal.
Well, but they're,
sure they
they're fictionalized and greatly... sentimentalized, I guess. I guess it's
no,
not exactly
sentimental. I make them worse, usually. No, and they're quite the opposite of sentimental. In other words, I make the pollution of the towns and the stories worse than it really is. And
right.
I make the disaster in the army worse than it was, which is done for the purpose of making a point, you see. It's like a caricature, or it's any work of fiction. Is not really made up. It's not a lie made from start to finish. The author, if you knew the guy, if you really did know Updike, I'm sure that Updike is basing Rabbit, the Rabbit Redux and that, on himself. And people who know him know various incidents in the book that are literally out of his life. But the ordinary reader doesn't know that. So he just assumes, well, Updike's writing fiction. Well, what is fiction then? Well, fiction is really taking your own life and putting it into a form that it may not have had. Now, form is not the same as substance. He puts it to a form. So when I tell a story about a kid going to a prom, well, I did go to a prom. So did you. Everybody's going to a prom. What happens specifically moment by moment at my prom is not necessarily the way it comes out in the story, because I'm not a reporter. I'm a storyteller. But what I do put in that story is true. It has happened to others. In other words, it's the possibility that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You follow what I'm saying there? Now that's very different from say just fantasy, where you just take a completely made up concept and then you begin to embroider on that, and it has a certain sterility because of that.
Still, these things come basically from inside your head.
Sure. Uh-huh. Well, they do. I mean, after all, Melville wrote Captain Ahab. He wrote it comes out of your head, yes. But it's a combination of experience and observation. That's really what fiction is. It's neither one nor the other.
We have to.
In other words, in other words, it's when Joseph Heller wrote Catch 22. Did you read Catch 22? Well, obviously, he was also in the war. He was also in the army. You know, Heller himself. So Catch 22 is a combination of things he saw and then his imagination overlaid on what he saw. Oh, I'm sorry, we got a break or something.
No, we don't have a break. I just wanted to get you to play your juice harp there, because we are in the Luke O'Reilly Show here. You were so late. I mean, you know, you're going to continually do this to me.
Well, you want me to...
Yes, I'll let Doug take this mic, and maybe you can work out an arrangement here.
You got your juice harp with you?
Yeah, well, it's a little dime store moment, so I got it here.
That's a good one.
You like this? It's one of the English ones.
Smith.
Is it?
Yeah.
It'll give me a
brand. Let me see it.
Yeah, it's a little bit rusted over. Vintage model.
Maestro Shepard is examining the juice harp here.
Yeah, this is a Smith type.
It's remarking on the type of the juice harp.
It is a copy of an English juice harp called a Smith. It's a good one, by the way. It's not a dime store type.
Well, that's where I got it.
Yeah, but it's not you are very lucky. This is not a dime store type. That's It's a good jew's harp.
Why? It's served me well. I notice we have slightly different methods of playing. You use it against the teeth. Now I stick it up against the lips.
Well, then you're not an orthodox jew's harpist. You've picked it up then.
Well, this is the style I did pick up. In fact, I picked it up, of course.
No.
First performance, by the way, was along with the high school band at my graduation.
How'd it go?
Well, it was before I had managed to master the volume technique on it, so it was a little tough. Most people didn't hear it.
What did you play?
It's Pomp and Circumstance.
Oh, that's a good one. That's good.
It's good. It was basically backup, though. This is like within my second week of playing.
Da, 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 da.
I like to do it along with some bluegrass things, you know, with the background.
Yeah, well, that's the sound that you should try for. Did you hear any of the stuff I did on my LP?
I just got it about a day or two ago.
Well,
I haven't had a chance.
Listen to the jew's harp side on that. Mm. There's some good jew's harp on there.
Well, the reason I specifically wanted to hear you play some stuff was that the only time I saw you at Rutgers, you took it out, you're all set to play it, and some wise guy started laughing in the back, and you put it away and refused to play anymore.
Well, I'm a very serious jew's
harpist. Well, I know.
That would be like Van Cliburn sitting down to his Baldwin, and three guys start to laugh, he'd get up and leave. Yeah. But you were at that Rutgers concert.
I think it's the last one you did at the Ledge, before they turned it into the world's largest vending machine.
Yeah, I hear that place really went downhill quickly. Mm-hmm.
Well, they built a new student center, which is now below that.
Yeah. I have been invited to play Rutgers this spring. Do you think I ought to?
Depends on where they ask you to play.
Well, the big hall there, student activities. I don't know what the name of the place is.
It's the
place that superseded the Ledge, you said.
Yeah, well, I know the place well.
What would you think?
It's got a bad PA system.
Well, I wouldn't worry about that.
You
know,
you got a big following there.
I don't need the PA system. I think I generally project over that.
I think you go over well. Yeah.
The worst PA system I ever ran into was one fantastic PA system. I had about a 5-watt PA system. I think somebody put it together from a Heath kit, and it was in a 3,000-seat auditorium. The guy said. Don't worry. He says we got a great PA system, and I took one look at it, and it I could see it was roughly 5 watts, and they had the Sears Roebuck microphone, and they had these two little 8-inch Japanese speakers.
I've seen that microphone. It's the one they make out of the comb with the phone book paper.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, it's got the tissue paper dye.
Right.
Yeah, Scott Tissue makes it. Well, what do you want? You want me to play the jew's harp?
Yeah,
something. Since you saw me work. No, I'd like to ask you some questions.
Sure.
Now, you went to Rutgers.
Right.
What'd you major in there?
I was an electrical engineer.
Get a degree in?
I have an official degree that says this guy is an electrical engineer, qualified to push buttons at any radio station.
Well, you got an EE then?
Yeah, I do.
Well, that's interesting, because that's how I started.
Really?
No, I started in engineering, because I have a ham ticket.
Yeah? Yeah, I know. I've heard you talk about that. The great ham wedding.
Yeah.
Just a second. We'll pause for a moment, and we'll get you set up for your jew's harp act.
Well, I can't play my jew's harp unless I have some music with me. Jew's harp, an a cappella jew's harp doesn't make it.
Well, would you like Lever Brothers close up?
Well, I don't care.
Well, here. Why don't you try it? Here, let me give you the mic.
The headphones here. I mean, a jew's harp. I don't know whether it's in my key. Well, it's a nice sound though.
Here we go.
I'll tell you that.
Close-up toothpaste for the close-up smile.
Come a little closer, baby, smile for me. For a little while, for a little while. Look into my eyes, touch my hand. I need a close-up smile from you. I need a close-up smile.
Do you have a close-up smile? Or your teeth are whitest white? Is your breath really fresh? If not, you need Close-Up, the toothpaste and mouthwash in one, in regular or mint flavor. Close-Up toothpaste for the close-up smile.
Don't just stand there, smile for me, and I won't feel alone. Come a little closer, baby, smile for me. I need a close-up smile from you, I need a close-up smile.
Very nice.
Ladybug,
hear it?
Yeah. And since clothes from the Ladybug stores are what she wears, then doesn't it make sense to find her Christmas presents there? Wherever you are, there's a Ladybug store nearby. 1516 Chestnut Street, Plymouth Meeting Mall, Cheltenham Shopping Center.
There he comes.
Leo Kottke is appearing Thursday, December 9th through Sunday, December 12th at the Main Point in Bryn Mawr. For information, call LA53375.
Come on, fall in here. Nice going.
That's it. Well, I think we're just about out of time. Luke O'Reilly is just itching to come in here.
What's he want to do?
Take over. Is it that radio show?
Is it that Exuma again?
No.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he says he's itching to get in here. I couldn't help
it. Oh, well,
wait a minute. Let Luke come in here. It's been great having you. You want me to hang around or what?
Sure, hang around. Well, we'll go outside. We'll all go outside.
Yeah, good. We'll go out and have a...
All right. Luke, want to come in? Luke, where are you?
Luke, where is Luke?
Luke isn't here, but I think he wants a Yardbirds record. We've been talking to Gene Shepherd, better known as Shep or that nut from Radio New York, and the other enterprises, and buy his album, and we'll see you tomorrow. This is the Yardbirds.
And the guy that comes just before.
It's a very, very recognizable hit. Lucky to join in if you can.
It's best, by the way, if you listen to this in stereo, because... I'm on one channel, and Shep is on the other channel, and it works out nicely. I'm not quite sure which way it comes out, who's where. But listen, because it's very interesting. have asked for it, but there it was.